think that one of the viruses or memes that's been implanted in our ranks is that there is an enemy people. And whenever you go that way, and I don't go that way, then you're falling into their snare. Because the enemy is not any group of people. The enemy is an ideology. It's a spirit. It's a spiritual ideology. It can affect you. It can infect me. It can infect any nation of people. No one is invulnerable to it.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We're going to stay here all night if we have to, so let's get started.
Can I go when this starts to suck?
If there's a witness in the house tonight that nothing succeeds like success, say yes. If this world is an oyster, then I came to eat it out until it leaves scratch marks all around my neck. I guess we all know people who couldn't win even if everyone else in this world forfeited. If God gave some people Michael Jordan's talent, they would just lay up and not be able to score with it. But because I love you, I'm about to do things to this microphone that none of you will ever forget. My brothers, you will leave here tonight with your brains hard. My sisters, you will leave here tonight with your minds wet. Make no mistake. What you see in front of you is a God. My sisters, no need to twist up your faces. My brothers, no need to nod. Just look at me. There is energy surrounding me like skin. And when this thing here tonight ends, I want you to all come closer to me. Because I am now qualified to show each and every one of you how things are supposed to be. Our supervisor has authorized me to give each of you insight into the 36 degrees of exactly what your soul controls. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't show you how to put candle wax in tops and shoot scales with my yacht, to do cannabis with anubis and use feathers to measure hearts, to smoke angel dust with angels and hit meth with Mephistopheles while other souls fall victim to prophecy for improperly trying to copy these signs and symbols of the galaxy. Their fallacy is in their analogy. They've become over-dependent on technology instead of using their minds to shape this reality. But you have created me to poetically show you what you need to see, but that you have called me into existence, there is no such soul as Talam Acey. Your mind has placed me on this stage, at this hour, on this day, to show you things that you have already suspected, but needed psychosomatically suggested to you anyway. If there's a witness in the house tonight that nothing succeeds like success, say yes. There are those people who make things happen, those people who watch things happen, and those people who find out what happened through Soap Opera Digest. I guess we all know people who couldn't get a life if they were giving them away free with traffic tickets. It's sad to say, but some people are stuck on failure, like adolescent boys are stuck on pornographic pictures. But my beloved, none of us are made out of any special molecules. No, every molecule is infinite. And all things found outside it can also be found within it. And in that sense, nothing is ever created or invented. Energy just changes from form to form. They say the only thing new in this world is the history you haven't heard yet. The only advantage other souls have over yours is the mathematics you haven't learned yet. It is through mathematics that I have collected these degrees. It is through mathematics that I no longer need a J-O-B. It is through mathematics that I've had the audacity to hire 3 employees. And check this out. I still have no idea what I do for a living. The one thing that permeates this existence is balance. And those of us who succeed add 180 degrees to each challenge. We think, walk, talk, and interact to the intermittent frequencies of the galaxy. And those of us who fail, fail because we refuse to use our minds to redesign this reality. They put their lives in the hands of the universe like dice, then look surprised when the universe hands them back snake eyes. If there's a witness in the house tonight that nothing succeeds like success, say yes. God could put a big fat yellow halo over some people's heads all day, and they would still refuse to believe that they were blessed. I guess we all know people who couldn't prosper, even if you gave them 50 grand on consignment. Them punks would probably go out and cop a platinum Rolex, get robbed for it, and spend the rest of their lives wondering where the time went. Success is never a mistake. It is always premeditated karma.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
We released three Moroccans from Gitmo a while back under the previous administration. They went home for a while and then they decided to go fight in Syria. They're fighting on the same side as we are in Syria. So people who hate America are on our side, which concerns me a bit and confuses me a bit. We're supporting a Sunni sort of movement. It has people we say we're not going to give weapons to, but we did give some to a military council that said recently they're going for the Golan Heights when they're done with Assad. That's confusing to me to be on the same side as people who are going to try to reclaim the Golan Heights. It's a Sunni resistance. It also has parts of ISIS in it, but now we are sort of supportive of ISIS, not really, but we're on the same side as ISIS in one battle, and we'll be in the other. So you tell a GI who's going to carry a gun and put his life down, and I know a guy from my neighboring town lost both legs and an arm, and he fought for freedom, he fought for a Bill of Rights, he fought for a Constitution, but you can see how it might be confusing when you send a soldier back in there that you say, well, Iran supports Hezbollah and the Alawites and the Shiites, but Iran also likes Maliki and the Shiites in there. So, I mean, you can see how it's very confusing. We're on both sides of two different wars. To be at war and to kill people and to fight and to lay down your life, it's hard for me to be certain that I'm excited to go. I mean, I hate that Mosul is falling, and I hate that those are falling. But I also think we for 10 years we've supplied the Iraqis. They can't stand up and do anything to defend their country, and it is all up to us. It's hard for me, and I think it's easy from a geopolitical point of view. All the things you say are rational and logical, but I see this also emotionally from a GI who has to go over there and potentially lose his life, an American, that I'm concerned that it's confusing. Which side are we on? We're for the Sunnis in one war, and we're against the same set of Sunnis in another war in a neighboring place. It's all destabilizing, but you could even go back 10 years and say, you know what? It might have been a little more stable when we had that awful guy Hussein who hated the Iranians. I mean, so I'm not saying that I'm for having Hussein there. I'm just saying that geopolitically you had people somewhat at a standstill over there, and now you have a really confusing mess that makes it hard for me or for a GI to understand who he's shooting at and why, and he's shooting at one person in one war and a different person in another war.
Here's my problem. If we're going to send American men and women to go fight, then we've got to have victory in mind. There was an article written today by John Nagel, a veteran of both Iraq wars, headmaster at the Haverford School, author of Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war. And he wrote a piece, and the headline today is, as an Iraq vet, this is not why my friends fought and died for, what they fought and died for.
Yeah, and not only do we have to have victory in mind, and that's what Reagan talked about, we go in to win, but Reagan also talked about consensus of the country. And that's why if we decide that we're going back into Iraq, this can't be under a 10-year-old vote of Congress. There should be a new vote of going to war in Iraq. If people in America want to go back into Iraq, realize we lost 4,000 soldiers, are we willing to lose 4,000 more to fight against a group that's actually allied with a group that we're supporting in Syria?
My windowsill, two birds sitting there perfectly still, one of them up to no good, the other one doing what he told he should. I think about the culprit, looks like you, it must be you, it
must be you. And found nothing better yet. What's the matter with you? You got nothing to do.
Crumbling under the force of a renegade al-Qaeda splinter group that's sweeping the north. Now, the U.S. president is considering airstrikes and drone attacks. The so-called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria insurgent group have captured the whole province of Nineveh. In this video, you can see some 3,000 Iraqi soldiers surrendering to the militants, and now their sites are in Baghdad, and fighting's being reported just 50 kilometers from the capital. The UN says that hundreds of civilians have been slaughtered by the insurgents. RT's Ganesh Chikan looks at what effect America's offer of help to tackle the militants might have.
Militants with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria are now in control of large parts of Iraq, including its second largest city of Mosul. They're now aiming at the capital, Baghdad. The fight against Assad in Syria has bolstered these Islamist militants and gave them new resources. And the sectarian feud in Iraq has allowed the group to gain momentum and recruits. The sectarian war in Iraq broke out after the U.S. invasion in 2003 and has been a source of constant violence ever since. Now the U.S. may invade again to stop the onslaught of the Islamist militants.
My team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them. I don't rule out anything because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria.
Birds of a feather may lay together, but the uglier one is always under the gun. Birds of a feather may lay together, but the uglier one is always under the gun. Birds of a feather may lay together, but the uglier one is always under the gun. Birds of a feather may lay together, but the uglier one is always under the gun.
Military officials say five American troops were killed in an apparent coalition airstrike in southern Afghanistan. They were special operations forces on patrol with Afghan forces. They came under fire, and the air support they called in might have made a major mistake with tragic consequences. ABC's Karen Travers has more from Washington.
A tragic mistake in Afghanistan may have led to the deaths of five U.S. service members. American Special Operations Forces were out on a security patrol with Afghan forces along the southeastern border with Pakistan. They were ambushed by the Taliban and came under heavy fire. They called for air support, U.S. warplanes to come out to assist. Sources said there was a miscommunication about where exactly the bomb should be dropped, and it looks like a U.S. B-1 bomber dropped it on the wrong spot. Five Americans and one Afghan were killed. It's unclear how many others were wounded. This could be the worst friendly fire incident in the nearly 14-year war. It comes just 2 weeks after President Obama made a surprise visit to Afghanistan.
For many of you, this will be your last tour in Afghanistan.
Together, but the ugly one is always under the gun. Birds of a feather may lay together, but the ugly one is always under the gun.
Clashes broke out in Jerusalem on Friday as Israeli security forces allegedly stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The mosque, located in the walled Old City of Jerusalem, is the third holiest site for the Islamic religion. To Jewish people, it is known as the Temple Mount and is also revered in their religion. Israeli security personnel guarding one of the gates to the compound were reportedly pelted with stones by 20 masked Palestinians following noon prayers, according to an Israeli police spokesperson. Stun grenades were used to disperse the stone throwers. Sovereignty of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome on the Rock Shrine compound is at the heart of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Palestinian sources say that Israeli forces have been increasingly trying to violate Palestinian freedom of worship, and this latest clash is another attempt to spread terror into the hearts of worshippers. It's been reported by a local medical clinic that 28 Palestinians were injured in Friday's clash, and police said they had detained 8 people.
Hey, what's the problem here?
We were fighting over which one of us loved you more.
You were? Aw, well, go ahead.
You love him more.
No, you do.
No, I don't. Yes, you do. No.
Who is the who? Telling who what to do? Who is the who? Telling who what to do? Tell me who, tell me who, tell me who. Well, one and Abel were crossing the road. One had a feeling there was something he was owed. But Abel broke it to him that there's a social code. So walk straight down the middle now and do what we're told. Walk straight down. That didn't feel so good to never be fulfilled, forever stressed out and impatient, always saying just over the next hill, always saying just over the next hill. Who is the who telling who what to do? Being evil is to freedom what wanting is to cruel. It's freedom a gift that we only give to the ones that say I love you? Who is the who telling who what to do? Who is the who telling who what to do? Who is the who telling who what to do? Tell me who, tell me who, tell me who. Now one and Abel are two different things. One is desire and the other is the means. Like I wanna hold you and see you and feel you in my dreams. But that's not possible. Something simply will not let me.
Police in Canada are on high alert after 3 men escaped from a prison in a helicopter. The 3 inmates escaped on Saturday evening from a jail in Quebec City after a helicopter briefly landed at the prison to pick them up, prompting a massive manhunt. The jail is said to have minimal security, with only a few layers of barbed wire around a courtyard, and this is the second helicopter-aided escape in Quebec in 2 years. At least 2 of the men were arrested in 2010 over drug-related charges and were waiting to stand trial. The men are thought to have ties to the Hells Angels, according to local reports. Authorities believe that one pilot was in the helicopter when it arrived at the prison, though the exact details of the escape are still being investigated.
body comes and tells me it's wrong. Whenever I'm doing just as I please, somebody cuts me down to my knees. Yeah, somebody cuts me down to my knees. In a time when everybody feels entitled, why can't I feel entitled too? Somebody took away my God-given right. Guess God must have gave it to you. I guess God must have sent it to you. Stop what you're doing and get back in line. I hear this from people all the time. If we can't be happy, then you can't be too. I'm tired of being told what to do. Yeah, I'm sick of being told what to do.
Students have been evacuated from a US high school following reports of gunfire. Some are injured and authorities say the suspect is dead after the shooting incident at Reynolds High School near Portland, Oregon. TV news showed students being led from the school with hands on their heads and some were inside texting their parents. A parent interviewed on TV said she heard her son was okay, but was still concerned.
I just heard that he was okay, but he doesn't know what's going on. I just want to see him to make sure he's okay. You know, just personally see him. It scares me.
Police were called to the school shortly after 8 a.m. on Tuesday and told parents to go to a nearby car park to meet with their children as they were evacuated from the school.
Children today who are lied to, told the world is rightfully theirs. They can have what they want, whenever they want. They take like Caesar and nobody cares. Live like Caesar and nobody cares. I can't bring myself to take without penance. Atonement or sweat from my brow. Though the world may be spoiled and getting worse every day, don't they feel like they cheated somehow? I feel like I've been cheated somehow. Stop what you're doing and get back in line. I hear this from people all the time. I'm tired of being told what to do. Yeah, I'm sick of being told what to do. Not mothers, not children, not kings. Not one single person on God's golden shore is entitled to one single thing. We don't deserve a single damn thing.
A new trend in offices across the country. More and more people are switching to fetal position desks so that they can curl up in a ball on the floor while they work. Aaron Vaughn has a story.
I'm here at the offices of Slash Forward Marketing, one of the many companies where employees are throwing out their chairs in favor of working from the fetal position. Wellness experts say it's the best way to stay healthy and productive at work.
The human body isn't meant to sit at a desk for 6 or 7 hours. The natural position, especially in the workplace, is to shut down completely, return to a womb-like state, and rock back and forth to soothe yourself.
A new study shows that the healthiest way to deal with the penetrating drudgery of the workday is to work from a comfortable surface with your back curved, head tucked in, and your arms wrapped around you to block out the outside world.
I work at a computer all day. Sitting in a chair, I found that my neck would hurt, my back would hurt. I'd spend full days watching the minutes of my life slip away.
Company president Robert Bettendorf says the trend is catching on with his employees.
We found that before we switched over to these desks, employees were already assuming the fetal position throughout the day, putting their heads between their knees and shutting it all out for even just a few minutes. It's what people naturally wanted to do.
Fetal position desks, which are even popping up in offices like Google and Facebook, come in a variety of shapes and sizes. Some have adjustable height so you can cower underneath them, while more expensive options include a warm, pulsating blanket for workers to wrap themselves in to feel calm. But many people are making their own.
I've rigged this up so I can type comfortably and my arms won't get tired. Plus, it's got speakers so I can listen to a comforting voice saying shh over and over again.
The workday goes by a lot faster. I feel better, I have more energy, and I don't get that 2:30 feeling anymore where I'm like, oh no, didn't I want to be a novelist? Before I know it, I'm at home watching Netflix in the fetal position on my bed.
Some offices are rethinking assigned seating altogether, letting employees work however and wherever they want. The result? Surprising collaborations and a free exchange of ideas. But if you're not ready to give up your traditional desk entirely, experts say you can still get some of the benefits of fetal position desks with a few simple exercises.
We recommend that all workers take 20 to 30 minutes out of every day to write the word suicide. Over and over again in a Google Doc. Make that a part of your routine.
I've tried a fetal position desk myself, and I can say it's a great way to get through the f***ing day.
Thanks, Aaron. I hate my job.
So cooperative conflict and wrestling with ideas, I think, is fine. But there's a particular kind of conflict, as I've mentioned, that I think is especially disturbing, and that is competition. Basically, there are two respectable positions to take on competition in this country. One is unqualified endorsement, and the other is qualified endorsement. Unqualified endorsement is the Vince Lombardi quote, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there," or perhaps given how early it starts now with preschool, we should say a doggy-eat-doggy world out there. And we've got to get kids primed for as much canine consumption as possible very early. If you can't stand the heat, etc., it's good for us, and so on. The second position, the only other one, is one that says something like, competition has gone too far in this country. We push kids too fast and too hard to be number one. But if we keep things in perspective and don't get carried away, then competition can be natural and appropriate and healthy and so on. That used to be my position. But in writing No Contest, I went through more than 400 studies, and slowly I came to a third camp, which may be occupied only by me at this point. And that is as follows, that competition is not destructive or counterproductive in its excess. It is not destructive because we're doing it the wrong way. It is destructive by its very nature. The very phrase, healthy competition, it seems to me, and I think there are good, though largely unknown, data to support this. The phrase, healthy competition, is a contradiction in terms. And the ideal amount of competition, note I do not say conflict, the ideal amount of competition in any environment, the classroom, the workplace, the family, the playing field, is none. Now, I don't expect that most of you will agree with this. I didn't myself. But I want you to open to the possibility that all things that are bad in excess are not necessarily good in moderation. That's a surprising concept. I like to say to audiences who challenge me on this, you know, hey, well, you know, you don't want to be so radical about it. We need some competition. I say, you know, I agree with you. I think the same thing is true about torturing children. We don't want to overdo it, but you can't have none at all now, can you? The point is that not everything is good in a middle ground. We love this sort of reflexive position of let's not overdo it, but we need some. Some things are inherently destructive. This position has not won me plaudits all over the country, as you can imagine. I'm alternately called a communist and a wimp as I discuss these things. Although never both, you know. Never. I guess you don't need to be spending $300 billion on the Pentagon if the communists, well, you see what I mean. But the It's one or the other. But the position is one that I think is backed by research, even though it sounds radical. The idea is that competition, no matter what amount it exists in, is always to that extent destructive. Some competitions are worse than others. Let me define my terms in good social science fashion here. I like to distinguish between what I call structural and intentional competition. By structural competition, I mean what I call mutually exclusive goal attainment, which is a fancy social science expression for I succeed only if you fail. There is a stronger version of this in which I succeed only if I make you fail. You see the difference? In the first case, maybe talking about golf or bowling, I do something, you do something, I do something, you do something. And at the end, of course, we're Americans, we have to have a winner, we compare scores. But we don't interfere with each other's performance. In the stronger version, I succeed only if I make you fail, here we find it in war or tennis. In which, in order for me to do well, I have to actively interfere with how you do it. So a good shot in tennis, for example, is one that you cannot return. That's true by definition. The goal, the objective of the activity is not merely to succeed at the end, but at each moment to interfere with your success. That doesn't mean all tennis players are nasty or neurotic or malicious. It means that the rules of the game, the structure, so to speak, require us to succeed at the expense of other people's failure. And that is what I am arguing is always and by its nature unnecessary and destructive. And I distinguish that structural competition from intentional competition, by which I mean simply the need for one person to be number one. Here we're talking not about the rules of the game, but about the personality. And why I think it's interesting to distinguish between the two is simply that we can have one without the other, and it helps us to clarify matters. Can we have intentional competition without structural? You bet. Some people may have come in here today with their objective being to be asked the cleverest question, or to be the best dressed, or something of that sort, be the funniest. Nobody else is trying for that. There are no trophies being given out. Everyone else just thought they were coming to a lecture. You know, they didn't realize it was a competition as it is for that individual. But even worse, you can have the reverse situation. I think it's worse. Structural competition without intentional. This is something we see every day in this culture. Individuals who are satisfied with simply doing their best, having fun, reaching excellence, but have to do that, have to engage in those goals in a way that prevents other people from reaching theirs. Success and victory, which are two completely different ideas, have been confused, confounded in this society, so we can't understand what it is to do one, to reach one without reaching the other. We have to tease these apart. I'm all in favor of success and excellence, as I am conflict in certain situations. The question is, do we have to do it to the exclusion of other people? I think the answer to that is clearly no. And in my book, I go through the four central myths of competition, which I will summarize very quickly now because I want to move on to the work that I'm doing since that book has come out. Let me deal with three consequences of competition and what has driven me to this surprising view that it's not merely bad in excess. First, there's the question of productivity or excellence, success. This was the trickiest one. To be very honest with you, when I began this project, I already accepted that competition wasn't very good for us psychologically or for our relationships with each other. But I bought the party line that you needed some competition in order to push yourself to do your best. That there was some dialectical relationship between the two, and we couldn't dispense with that competition without there being a trade-off. Maybe it was worth it. Well, I was wrong. After going through hundreds of studies in the classroom and the workplace, I have become convinced of what I will put into one bold and startling proposition. Not only is competition not required for excellence, its absence is required for excellence. Now, most of these studies, all of these studies really, are available in any good library, but they don't get read and they certainly don't get talked about in the public arena or mentioned in popular publications for the most part. We are brought up not only to compete frantically, but to believe in competition, and it is awfully threatening to have people come along and say, you have been deluded. You are barking up the wrong tree. This is not what leads people to do their best. The Johnsons, David and his brother Roger, have done themselves scores of studies in the classroom. Others have been done by people like Bob Slavin at Johns Hopkins University, and many others, who have shown repeatedly that cooperation predicts to learning I'm talking bottom line, hardcore success for children and adults whenever there's learning involved. Cooperation predicts to that more than does competition or individualized attainment. It's true in rural, urban, and suburban schools. It's true for all ages. It's true for all subject matters. The only place they found some variation is that the more complicated the task is, the worse competition does. The more cognitive problem solving and creativity is required, the worse competition stacks up when measured against cooperative approaches. This sort of thing has been found in the workplace too, both in terms of structural and intentional. There have been studies structurally suggesting that people in cooperative workplaces, real-world situations, not some contrived laboratory setup, do better when they're working together than when they're trying to best each other. As well, there have been studies from the University of Texas showing that personal need to compete, what I call intentional competition, gets in the way of success. I don't want to bore you with all these studies now. They're in my book, and others have come out since my book. But the point is that this counterintuitive for us Americans finding has been borne out again and again, even when researchers expected to find the reverse. And one after another, you see them saying, counter to hypothesis. Why? I think there are three reasons. The first, and I'm oversimplifying here because of the limited time available to me, and also because sometimes I get a kick out of oversimplifying. First, competition causes anxiety. When you are trying to beat someone and they're trying to beat you, you are distracted from doing the best job you possibly can because you're afraid someone else is going to step on your face. Not because they're mean, but because that's what competition by nature requires. Second, cooperation allows people to share their talents and their skills and their resources in a way that competition never does. This organization was founded by an astronaut. I've always asked, oh yeah, you think we would have gotten to the moon that fast if we weren't in a race against the Russians? Well, assuming that is a good goal, by the way, a question that is almost never asked when you're in a race, but assuming it is a good goal, I think we would have gotten there an awful lot faster had we been cooperating with the Russians. Because competition, among its other faults, is redundant. It's wasteful. It's duplicative. They're solving problems we've already solved, and vice versa. Only when you're able to share can you get there faster and more efficiently. You could share in a competition, but you'd be nuts. It's irrational. Why should I help you if your success comes at the expense of mine? You can't do it in a competitive situation. And that's the other reason why competition is so unproductive, so inefficient, because it doesn't allow for that. And the third reason is, in a way, the simplest and the most subtle at the same time. Not only is the idea of success or excellence completely different from victory or beating other people, not only are they conceptually different, but in actual life they pull in opposite directions. The more I'm focused on getting that reward of being number one, the less I am concerned about what the task itself has to offer. You remember this kid in school? Ooh, 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 waving her hand wildly. Ooh, teacher finally calls on her. What was the question again? Why? Because she's not thinking about the subject matter. She's thinking about being number one. And those often are mutually exclusive in practice, the way they feel, in addition to the way the concepts are in themselves. Now, competition in this respect shares something destructive with all external or extrinsic rewards, whether it's not just the trophy, but grades or money. The more we think of ourselves as working for that goal, the less are we concerned about the intrinsic motivation, what's there in the task itself. Not only are external rewards such as competition less effective as motivators, but in fact they undermine intrinsic motivation. So that people who used to find something very interesting in its own right, once they start doing it in a competitive fashion or for money, you take away that money or the competition and they suddenly lost interest in it. There's a whole literature in the social psychology on this, and it is very powerful in contradicting the ways parents and teachers and managers have been leading their organizations or their homes. People have been systematically undermining curiosity, the single most important predictor to success, in the process of trying to help it along. Let me tell you a quick little anecdote that illustrates that. There once was an old man who was taunted by the neighborhood school children. After they came out of school, they would walk onto his lawn and yell, "Hey, you stupid old bald-headed ugly," you know, and so on. And he got tired of this pretty fast. So he came up with a plan. He said, "If you kids come back tomorrow and yell those things at me, I'll pay each of you a dollar." Well, they thought that was pretty good. They hadn't expected it. So they came back even earlier the next day. And they yelled even louder about how ugly and stupid he was. And he came, and he said, "Thank you. Here's your dollar. Here's your dollar. Here's your dollar. Here's your dollar. If you come back tomorrow, kids, I can pay each of you a quarter." Well, they thought that was still pretty good. So they came back the next day and yelled even more loudly about how stupid and ugly he was. And he paid each of them a quarter. And he said, "Thank you. If you come back tomorrow, I can only pay each of you a penny." They said, "A penny? Forget it." And they never came back again. You see the serious point here? He bought off their intrinsic motivation. And that's exactly what competition does. That's the whole idea. That's what he was trying to do. But it's not what teachers and managers are trying to do, and it's exactly what they're doing anyway. Those are the three reasons I think the research shows with surprising uniformity that competition does not predict a success. But competition is destructive in another respect. And this one I think is more, requires less evidence. And that is that competition does not build character, whatever that means. If we mean by that something like self-esteem, the evidence is crystal clear here. I like to say that competition is to self-esteem as sugar is to teeth. That's what the evidence shows. In any competitive encounter, losing is always possible, and that feels lousy. But even when you win, you gloat for a while, you soar, you're impossible to live with. But you come down. In fact, you crash down, and you need more of it in order to get that same feeling. It's precisely like building up a tolerance to a drug. Or, if I can switch metaphors, it's like drinking salt water when you're thirsty. The solution is the problem. The emotional needs that we attempt to meet through competition are exacerbated by competition. They make us more dependent. They make our self-esteem more contingent. I am good so far as I beat these people in these activities. There is no winning there. It is not the way to solve those emotional problems. Winning doesn't do it, and losing doesn't do it. Competition only makes more of itself. And there's lots of evidence suggesting that cooperative people are not people lost in some amorphous pond, some blob of a group. In fact, people who are distinguished by their cooperativeness also tend to have more of an internal sense that they can control events. That may seem surprising, but the converse should not seem surprising. Competition does not promote strong, good individualism, in the best sense of that word. It promotes dependency, because competition requires other people. It requires that my self-evaluation is dependent on other people. I need you to beat, and I need you to watch me beat him. That has nothing to do with a strong sense of self, despite the prejudice of lumping together individualism and competition. The third thing that competition does is it poisons our relationships with other people. We are envious of winners, which is not a pleasant emotion. We are contemptuous of losers. If you think about it, there's no nastier epithet in the American lexicon than loser. And we're suspicious of just about everyone. Hostile toward them, because even if you're not my rival today, you could be tomorrow. So I'm going to hold you at a distance from myself. I'm going to hold a part of myself in reserve. Why should I trust you if you're my competitor? It's irrational. And all the empirical evidence suggests just what you would expect. People who compete, or people in competitive situations, communicate less effectively, are less trusting, are less sensitive to other people's needs, and less able to take their point of view, to do perspective taking. Kids who are cooperative, or adults who are cooperative, find that those skills are all increased in amazing ways. People sometimes ask, does competition cause aggression? Competition is aggression. The only question is whether it will occasionally manifest itself in outright violence. It is an againsting process. We are at loggerheads. We are working at cross purposes. And we do it in sports, and we do it in the classroom. Those spelling bees and competitive grading systems. Long after kids forget how to spell some long word, or forget who the 12th president of the United States was, or any of the, or the binomial equations. What they remember is the fundamental lesson of any competitive classroom, which is other people are potential obstacles to my success. That's what we teach in competition. And no kind of competition, not even the parent who says, okay, who can get into their pajamas fastest? No competition, not even a nice game of underhand softball, which is more underhanded than we might suspect. No competition at work, friendliest employee, let alone for bonuses. None of this is innocuous. It all strengthens and reinforces and fortifies this message that sets us against one another. The question is not, do we need some competition? The question is, which kind is worse than the other? And that's why I'm suggesting that we have to work not merely to change our individual selves, not merely to go to psychotherapy and look deep within to find why I'm being competitive. I'll tell you why you're being competitive, because you live in a society that demands it of you every day of your lives. And until we make structural changes, it is self-deluding to talk about the prospect of merely working from within out. That's good too. I heartily recommend to you that you stop yourself and say, why did I interrupt him again? Why do I see this need to prove how clever I am? Why don't I just sit and listen and maybe learn something? That's great stuff. But it's not going to get very far until we change our recreation and our education and our workplaces and our families so that competition is no longer required. That's a harder task. And we Americans are very suspicious of any kind of structural change. We love to blame individuals. You're poor? You're just lazy. Get a job. You committed a crime? You're evil. Put you in jail for the rest of your lives. Kids aren't learning in school? Teachers aren't any good. You need more homework, etc. This lets us off the hook very easily. Instead of looking at the deeper social and economic causes of these kinds of attitudes and these kind of behaviors. And that's what we have to change. And I'm afraid I have to take issue as well with my colleague Sam Keen in terms of changing the competition between the Soviet Union and the U.S. so we start competing about good stuff, like who can feed kids most. The answer to competition is not more competition. Any kind of competition, even in something that appears to be relatively salutary, something felicitous, something whose goal we all agree on, is going to fortify those underpinning structures that say we have to see who can be number one. The genuine alternative to being number one is not being number two. It's being able to dispense with these self-defeating rankings altogether. Let's see. Aren't some situations inherently unavoidably, I guess that's supposed to be competitive, such as a shortage of jobs for professors, etc. How can we structure things so that people in selective careers are not locked in a destructive competitive motivational structure? That's a very important question.
This is Ugradowski of We Are Change.org, and I'm outside here, Can Bayo, which is a community center started here in Barcelona, Spain, that used to be an abandoned building that people just came in here and took over 3 years ago. They're actually doing community service work and helping out these ladies customize their wheelchairs and upgrade them and fix them since the government is inadequate and can't do that. So it's people coming to help each other, which is an amazing thing. They also have a nice community garden here. And I'm joined by a friend of mine, Chris, who has been showing me around here. We just did an interesting story about Convias, one of the community centers that was destroyed. And my friend Chris here has been living in Barcelona for over 20 years. Yep. Now, Chris, what is the importance of these community centers here, and how did they start up?
Oh, well, the importance is a place for people to go and be free and self-manage themselves and their projects and their community without having to depend on the state.
Now, we visited this one behind us, which you're seeing has a big support solidarity for Convias, the squat community center that was just shut down a few days ago. And this place is massive. I mean, what used to be here?
Well, it was like a factory warehouse. Don't exactly know how you'd call it. It had different companies with their stocks and their machinery there. But it fell into disuse, I don't know when, quite a few years ago, because it had been abandoned and, you know, a big wall around it. The neighbours didn't have, well, there's a lack of public space in the neighbourhood, and they were making pressure to the local council for them to free up the area and make some use of it, which they didn't do. The council didn't do it, and the neighbours became more and more organised and said, well, we're going to break the door down and start doing it ourselves if you're not going to do it. And in the last minute, the council said, well, here you go, here are the keys. So it's sort of like, it's not exactly as squatted, but it's not state organized either.
Yeah. And it's very amazing inside, because they have rock climbing walls, they have huge libraries, they have huge concert halls that people here just naturally, without any government assistance, without any corporate influence, just came together and built for the people here. And now you see some of them being destroyed, but it seems like this is a natural response because of the economic turmoil here in Spain. There's 56% unemployment among the young people, 27% unemployment among everybody else, and the bankers have been doing the usual tricks of manipulating mortgages to take people's money away and also their homes here. So the community has come together. But Chris, you lived here 20 years. Economically speaking, how is Spain standing right now?
Well, you know, it depends who you are. There's some people that think nothing's changed or, in fact, become better. But they're a smaller and smaller percent, of course, of the population. People are hurting hard. There's a lot of families, none of the parents are working. The whole family's moved in with their grandparents and living off the grandparents' pension fund, which has constantly been reduced. So it's not very happy situation at all, really.
No. Yeah. Mm. Lots of austerity measures with higher taxes and less resources for the people that are being taken away here. How has the implementation of the European Union kind of been here? Because I know that also has an effect on everything here, especially with the local politics that have been also changing here very dramatically.
Well, it's been a complete disaster, really. Spain joined the European community. There was a flood of free money. Everybody thought they were rich all of a sudden. The banks were giving credit to people. You could buy a house which was way beyond your possibilities to pay it back. You get 100% finance, plus a car thrown in and trip to the Caribbean. Wow. You know, and then the economy turns sour, people lose their jobs, and no way to pay it back. That's something that they'd been fooled into. And now they're chucked out of their house. And in fact, in Spain, they have this crazy law that when you can't pay your mortgage, the bank repossesses the house, but you still owe the bank the money of your mortgage. So you don't have your house, and you have a huge debt. It's an impossible situation.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, being here 3 years ago, you've seen a lot of that frustration in the streets. Even before Occupy Wall Street, there was the Indignados, the Ocupados, in Plaza de Catalunya here, where people have gathered and took over the local square on M15, and that really was a major, major movement. But politically speaking, where is that movement now, and how does it play into politics?
Well, yeah, when the 15M was in its in the Spanish Spring, people would shout that the politicians didn't represent us. We no nos representan, and little by little over the years, well, people have become more politically organized, and political initiatives are beginning to grow. And in fact, there's a political party that appeared 4 months ago. We've just had the European elections here last week. They registered as a party four months before the elections. And it was a complete surprise to everybody. They now have five represents rep, rep, rep,
representatives
in Brussels, in the European government there. So,
wow.
So that's and let's see what happens with the Spanish elections here in another couple, I think it's 2 years away.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people didn't vote for this new party because they'd never heard of it. So,
but they were still able and successful in getting 5 seats. In the European incredible. Government.
Nobody expected it at all. Nobody did. Yeah.
And now there's a lot of high hopes for this M15 Indignados political party to also win some political seats here in the Spanish election, not just the European elections, which are also coming up very soon. So even in Spain, where the economic situation is dire, people are coming together, organizing politically, winning political seats, and it looks like things are slowly changing.
But don't worry, we're all going to be living on nothing soon enough. And, you know, with a little bit of help from our friends, maybe, just maybe. I don't know. I have no idea.
Ah! Now, go find the others. .com.
Next up, new evidence suggests Shakespeare's plays may have been boring.